January 6th, we do not yet have a quorum, so we will begin with the public hearing on House Bill 20.
That's going to be two.
House Bill 2226.
And we're going to get a witness, I think Joanne Bowman from the Board of Dentistry.
And I'll call Joanne Bones from the Board of Dentistry.
Madam Chair, I'm Joanne Bones, Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry. Good afternoon. The bill as introduced makes a typographical correction to an error that was made in the dental faculty licensure law that was passed last session. It merely changes the word or to and. The use of the word or had the unintended effect of perhaps allowing somebody who does not an American Dental Association accredited degree to become a licensed under the dental faculty law. Both the Oregon Dental Association and the Oregon Health Sciences University School of Dentistry and the board supported the bill in its original form, but all of us overlooked the typographical error and request jointly that it be corrected. However, since we introduced this correction, the School of Dentistry has come to the board and asked for the board's support for further changes in the requirements for the dental faculty license. The Dean Turner's proposition to the board was referred to a committee of the board. That committee has met and reviewed the proposed changes. It will be making its recommendation to changes at the full board meeting this Friday. So I do not at this time have the board, the full board's position on the school's changes, proposed changes to the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Bones. And I believe that it is the intent of the chair not to act on the bill until after that meeting takes place. So perhaps next week.
Thank you.
Are there questions for Ms. Bones?
Could we vote on the OR, though, to resolve this part, or do you want to save that for later?
Representative Zunner, we're actually in a public hearing right now. So.
Right.
Are there any questions for Ms. Bones?
Thank you.
If not, thank you. And I'll call Jack Clinton. And possibly Brian Barringer is not here. Brian is here. Good afternoon.
Vice Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. I'm Jack Clinton. I'm the Associate Dean for Clinical Affairs at the OHSU School of Dentistry. And I'm here to explain a little bit of what this proposal is all about and some of the additions that Joanne Bones just mentioned. This House Bill 2226 is a proposed amendment to a bill that was approved last year, and the intent was to help the School of Dentistry address a very acute shortage in dental faculty. It turns out that the school in Oregon is not the only one. This is a national concern. Surgeon General David Hatcher even referred to it in his Oral Health of Americans report released in May of 2000. But there is a crisis in dental education, so we kind of fit into that same profile. We do have considerable concern, and so the intent of the bill is to help us or provide more tools, if you like, to help us be more competitive in recruiting those folks that are available for academic positions. And to that end, I guess there's a fairly lengthy rationale that we have distributed to you, and I'll not go through all of the rationale that is presented here. But in essence, we're looking at those folks who probably did not graduate from our school or from a domestic school for a pre-doctoral program. We're looking for ways for those that are exceptionally qualified to offer them a license, a faculty dental license. One of the significant things as we're recruiting, we find out that we do not match up well with salary packages. And one of our strategies is to provide an opportunity for faculty that we can recruit to provide them an opportunity to conduct a limited faculty dental practice. In order to do that, these people need a license. And so with the Board of Dentistry and with the Oregon Dental Association, we've worked out a plan for us to help us get past this licensure issue for these highly qualified folks that we're looking for.
Mr. Clinton?
Yes.
Very sorry to interrupt you. We do have Representative Shetterly here, and there is a bill that we're going to hear that he needs to testify on. So if you would be so kind as to just hold your thought, I will adjourn the public hearing on. Put in recess the public hearing on House Bill 2226, and I will open the public hearing possible work session on House Bill 2588. Yeah, that's fine. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee. Is this a hologram? Representative Lane Shetterly, District 34, and the sponsor of House Bill 2588. I appreciate your going and hearing on this. I have my own revenue committee in about 10 minutes. I will defer to Lou Ann Meyer, an accountant from Dallas, to give you the technical explanation of this really very simple bill. Also, I see that there is correspondence from Verlina Crosley from the Employment Department, and it's my understanding that a representative from the Employment Department is here to testify as to this bill as well. It really does something very, very narrow that will benefit a small number of employers in this state, but a small number is still a number of employers in this state, in that it will relieve them from some financial obligation for wage expenses where you have a situation where a single employer is considered an basically two employees at the same time, simultaneously employing the same individuals. I think Verlina Crosley in her letter refers to a disregarded entity as perhaps a one example being a subchapter S corporation that owns a subsidiary where both are treated under Oregon law as distinct employers, whereas under federal law, the subsidiary is disregarded so that for the purpose of determining their liability, in this case for an unemployment tax, under federal law, only one wage base is calculated. Under Oregon law, two wage bases are calculated, and so you have double payments in some cases on this, the same employees. Again, that's just a little bit of a five-mile overview. You have a lot smarter people than I able to explain this to you, but my emphasis is that while it's a small benefit or a benefit to a small number of employers, it still is a number of employers in the state who will have lower payroll costs on account of this without any detriment to the unemployment trust fund. I would call this a win-win, and I thank you for your consideration of it.
Thank you, Representative Shetterly. Are there any questions for the representative? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Next is...
you want to go back to the question? Mm-hmm. I think you do.
Okay. We will recess the public hearing on House Bill 2588, and we will reopen public hearing on House Bill 2226. Mr. Clinton?
Yes.
Thank you. I can probably make this pretty quick, and I'll get down to what it is that we're really proposing here after that kind of introduction. The change that we're looking for is to modify or to increase, I guess, the number of ways that foreign-trained dentists can gain an instructor's license or a faculty license through the school. And the underlying premise of this whole process is that first we must have whoever would be considered would have to have an educational requirement, which would be a minimum of 2 years of postdoctoral education in a program that has been accredited by the American Dental Association's Commission on Accreditation. And they would have to have completed that and have a certificate or a degree. So having that basis, what we're looking for is foreign-trained credentialed folks, but they must have completed at least a two-year program. And then we would say, besides having that, would be three possible ways that they could be approved for a faculty license. One of those ways would be to have held a faculty or an instructor's license in another state at another dental school immediately prior to employment by OHSU. That would be one of the possible secondary qualifications. Another possible way would having passed any clinical examination that the Oregon Board has approved. And the Oregon Board does approve a few examinations from other states. So if this person already has a license, then that would, from someplace else, that would be acceptable. And the third way that we're proposing that would be to having achieved a board certification in any of the nine specialties of dentistry that are recognized by, again, the American Dental Association Commission on Dental Accreditation. And so the changing of the or to and, or the and or, and I can't remember which it was, it was the right thing. But when we reviewed this, we wanted to then consider these things. And the basis for that, we actually had a few experiences this last year in recruiting that turned out to be disappointing, that we maybe could have been a little more competitive. Again, our desire is to give our school an opportunity to compete with some of these folks that are very qualified to teach, but we can offer them an opportunity to practice a little bit within the school's boundaries and offset some of our low salary structure that we have. We are very confident, and we reassured by the Oregon Dental Association and the preliminary involvement with the Board of Dentistry, that there have been no safeguards whatsoever that have been compromised as far as the health and safety of Oregon citizens. So we feel good about that. And one thing that we are often asked about is the license that we're proposing, a faculty license, is only valid as so long as that person is engaged in or is employed at the School of Dentistry. So if they, for some reason, would come here and decide to change their venue, work for somebody else, or whatever, they would not be able to go into the community. They would have to take the same licensure credentialing things that any other dentist. So it is simply, it's exclusively for those folks that would be on the faculty. And the final comment, I guess, is that we have met with the in a joint session in a study group with the Oregon Board of Dentistry, and they will act formally this next Friday. And at this time, we have no reason to believe that there will be any problem there. We're confident that that's going to be accepted. So we have all of dentistry is endorsing this in the state of Oregon. So So that's the essence of all the paper that we distributed for you, but I'd be happy to respond to any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Clinton? Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Dr. Clinton? Okay. Dr. Clinton, thank you for all you do for all the smiles of Oregon. We really appreciate it. Looking at the second page of your testimony, if you wouldn't mind, please, the one, two, three, third paragraph from the bottom. Having traveled in most of 178 countries in which my previous company operated, I'm well aware that numerous foreign entities do not have the excellence of programs we have here, as well as there are some that are outstanding. So I just wonder, in this third paragraph, where we meet the education requirements of a minimum of 2 years of postdoctoral education, now, is that anywhere?
Well, Representative Nelson, let me answer the question. It is specifically those 2 years of formal education or advanced education is very structured, and it would have to be in the United States or Canada, and it has to be an accredited program. So there's an immense amount of educational requirement for that to be, and it turns out it's exactly the same standard for a domestically trained doctor or dentist also. So anybody that can credential themselves to get into that program, then they're going to get exactly the same advanced education training, whether their previous experience was in a foreign country or if it was domestic. And usually we find those folks, to elaborate just a little bit, those folks that are admitted to these programs are ones that have done considerable retraining to really enhance their pre-doctoral experiences. So we're very, very sensitive to, I think, what the concern might be, and that is kind of the crux of the whole issue that we addressed last year also. And we're very confident that once they get into the program, for the advanced program, and then they credential themselves through there, that they are in fact equivalent to what would have happened if they had started in this country through the program.
Thank you. Yes, I appreciate that. And the USA, the answer is the equivalent of the training is in a U.S. Or Canadian institution. And may I follow up, please? So, what is the reason for the our deficit in dentists?
Well,
the cavity. What's causing the cavity in our dental profession?
Well, there's a number of things that contribute, and it's a fairly involved response, and I'll try to do it as quickly and as concisely as I can. One is that over the last 15 years, there have actually been a loss, a significant loss, about a 1,000 slots for dental students that have been lost through closures of dental schools, reduction in class sizes. So we have fewer slots that are available. We know on the other side of it that we have folks that are whose hairstyle is getting sort of like mine, that are we have more retirements than we have new entries. And this is Oregon is exactly like everybody else, maybe a little worse in this condition. So that's enough. We have much greater opportunities for people that are dentists than we've had in the past. And we find that the practice of dentistry, because probably of the economy, the economic times, is much, much better. And so it's a person that graduates from dental school, it's very attractive to go into practice because they're going to earn a lot more. They're probably going to work fewer hours if they choose to. And they're their whole lifestyle can be considerably different than going into the academic arena. And I guess the final thing is, in spite of what sometimes we think about, we have been making good headway, and there is a greater demand for dentistry. And so the dental health, the improved dental health is good, but we're also finding that more people want more service from the dental profession. So you put all those together, responding to a calling, if you like, for to teach isn't very high on most people's priority list. And so we do everything we can. We'd love to have the highest. We create some incentives. We do everything we can. So the essence of what we're trying to do here is to, I was thinking about how best to describe this, and I'm not a real investor, but the thought comes to me is this is a value investment thing. We're trying to look at value stocks, value people that have great potential, give them an opportunity, bring them along, and maintain the excellence that we have at this school. We have a great reputation here. We're very cautious and very careful about who we invite to be faculty. But there are some folks that happen to not be domestically trained that are absolutely excellent, and those are the folks we're trying to compete with.
Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum, is it a short question or maybe
it's a short
answer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a short question, which I hope will provoke a short answer. Dr. Clinton, the people who are operating with a dental instructor's license, do they treat patients in anything other than a teaching capacity?
Yes, they would treat them independently in a faculty practice that is housed totally within the university property.
And just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. What kind of supervision or who would ultimately be responsible in that setting?
They would have the same status as any practicing dentist in that setting.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Clinton. And I also wanted to note for the committee and for the record that Jane Myers dropped off some written testimony that should be entered into the record. And if you don't have that, we'll get you a copy of that. And we will bring this bill back at a later date. Is there anybody else that needs to testify on this particular bill today? If not, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2226 and bring it back at a later date. I notice we have the good representative from Pendleton here. And are you wishing to testify on House Bill 2094? In that case, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2094 and call the good representative Jensen from Pendleton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's a pleasure and privilege to be here to testify before you on House Bill 2094, which was brought at least in part by, or in total, by the sheriff from my district, Sheriff John Trumbull. And I've handed out to you compliments of the sheriff a copy of a letter that he has written, and I think was going to be handed out a little later, and I may have gotten a little ahead of what the schedule plan might have been, so my apologies for that. But Sheriff Trumbo is, for the record, Representative Bob Jensen from Pendleton. Sheriff Trumbo has been a very, very effective sheriff in my district, Umatilla County now, for some 6 years, and has done an excellent job in creating or in helping in the building of a new county / city jail facility, and in working with in the financial constraints that that sheriffs and correctional facilities across the state are having. However, an issue is being brought before you regarding medical services. And as it says in the letter here, in Umatilla County, we have two state correctional facilities, one Two Rivers Correctional Facility in Umatilla, and the other one Eastern Oregon Correctional Institute in Pendleton, the OCI as it's referred to by the department, I think. The problem the sheriff has with the number of prisoners now that are going through is difficulty in A, providing the medical care and help that is needed and would be demanded, and for which the county or slash city would be liable with the budget that they have. This this bill will would allow the sheriff's department to contract with the Department of Corrections for these facilities. And as Sheriff Trumbo tells you in his letter, his testimony there, the Department of Corrections has adequate to excellent medical facilities that are available there. It would allow him to be able to buy, for example, medications that are required by inmates in his custody at the rate that the State Department of Corrections gets those drugs instead of at the higher rate that he would have to pay, all of which would be a substantial savings to the county. As far as I can see, there is no downside to this legislation. I did contact the County Health Department. Sharon Klein, who is the director of the health department there, and you know, she found it to be found no objection to it and was perfectly willing, if necessary, to provide a written or documented support to the legislature that would in no way be in conflict with the County Health Department or in any way jeopardize the services that they are currently providing. So it winds up that we have possibility of being able to provide better health care in the jail at less money if the Sheriff's Department is able to contract with the Department of Corrections to provide that health care. And with that, I would answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jensen, are these state institutions or federal or?
The Two Rivers Correctional Institute is a state Department of Corrections prison. Eastern Oregon Correctional Institute is a state Department of Corrections prison. The facility that Sheriff Trumbo has is county jail, and the facilities that go along with county jail.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Jensen? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very kindly. I appreciate your consideration of this bill.
Why don't we call Steve, is it Ickes, from the Oregon Department of Corrections?
Good afternoon, Chairman Knope, members of the committee. I am Steve Ickes of the Oregon Department of Corrections. I am here to provide information and support on House Bill 2094, which was introduced at the request of the Department of Corrections. From time to time, county sheriffs and other local government officials have asked the department to commit our personnel and resources to assist them in responding in the event of a security or other emergency at the county jail, or in providing health care or treatment services for inmates confined in local jails or juvenile detention facilities. However, the statutes that created and established the department's duties and powers do not authorize the department generally to exercise custody over or to provide services to county jail inmates or youth confined in juvenile facilities. With this bill, the Oregon Department of Corrections requests expressed authority to enter into agreements or contracts with local governments to assist local government by providing technical assistance, health care services, and treatment services with respect to local correctional facilities and juvenile detention facilities. This bill does not require the department to provide services or assistance to local governments. It does grant clear authority to the department to do so when it is in the best interest of the department or our local governmental partners. Let me give you some examples. We have received expressed interest to provide services and assistance from several counties. Multnomah County and Marion County have requested in the past the opportunity to contract with us around our technical emergency response teams, which are known as our TERT teams. Marion, in addition, has wanted on occasion to contract with us for our dental services. Umatilla, Baker, Malheur would like to have contracted for medical, dental, and mental health services as well as our TERT teams. So if those are kinds of examples that can give you a feel for the kind of relationship and opportunities there, we're looking for issues of economy of scale, where there's a cost benefit to both parties involved, and that is just a few examples. I know there are others who wish to speak on this bill. I could answer any questions that you might have. Otherwise, I will let you get on with your business.
Thank you, Mr. Rickey. Is there any questions at this time?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rickey, it's just a question about your last economies of scale comment. Are you referring to excess capacity that you have right now?
No, what I was referring to, I'm sorry, Chairman Canope, Representative Rosenbaum, my concern and point would be that in many rural counties there is not a multiplicity of infrastructure in either security, health, or mental health issues. Many times we're in a position where if we were to contract with a local entity, a single provider could service both the prison system and the local jail.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify, would these be providers you're using right now, or these would be providers that you bring on specifically to?
Chairman Canope, Representative Rosenbaum, it could be either.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ickes. And we will move on down the witness list, and you'll hang around just a little bit.
I will.
There might be some more questions after some other witnesses. Rose Jade from Lincoln County.
Chairman Canope and the committee, thank you. My name is Rose Jade. I'm primarily a patent and trademark attorney. I live in Newport. My concern with House Bill 2094 is that it grants too much power and discretion to the Department of Corrections and local government. Specifically, subsection 2 is too vague and open-ended. My immediate concern is that if this bill is passed, DOC will rely on it as a grant of permission from the legislature to provide a DOC prison building facility to be used as a public courtroom. Currently, under ORS Chapter 1.185, and I've included copies of that in my packet, each county is to provide courtrooms, offices, and jury rooms. House Bill 2094 could be read to authorize the use of DOC facilities for these purposes under the, quote, assistance to local governments, end quote, provision of subsection 2. In the past 2 years, there have been at least 2 instances in Eastern Oregon where criminal trials were ordered by a judge to be held inside a state prison at the Snake River Correctional Institute in Ontario, Oregon. In at least one of these cases, jurors were forced to work inside the prison and were locked inside the prison during the day and at night during the performance of their jury duty. In the first trial, the public was completely barred from entering the prison to watch the trial. They were only allowed to watch a video feed of it that played at the Vail County Courthouse, approximately 25 miles away from the prison. After that first trial was over, a number of pretrial hearings on future trials to be held at the prison took place, and an out-of-county judge ruled that if criminal trials were to be held inside the prison, the public must be allowed to enter the prison to watch. I do not know if that ruling, it was Judge Lukanen's ruling, is being followed or not. The legality of this Oregon practice is currently before the state and federal courts of appeal. I represent the first person who was forced to have his criminal trial held inside the Snake River Prison, and I also represent the person who has filed a federal civil rights lawsuit over this practice because of his concern as a lawyer about secret courts and the unnecessary safety risks posed to jurors, attorneys, witnesses, and court staff who are forced to work inside a prison. However, I'm not here to debate the merits of those lawsuits. I'm here simply to warn you about how this bill may be interpreted after the fact by DOC and the Judicial Department if it is passed. If you, as a legislative body, decide that citizens should be forced to perform their jury duty inside state prisons, and that judges, defense lawyers, district attorneys, court reporters, witnesses, family members, the press, and other public attendees should be forced to enter a prison to attend or work at a public criminal trial, that is your decision and your right as a legislative body to make that public policy decision. However, I think these issues are complex and obviously involve important matters of public safety, prison security, and legislative accountability. If the DOC or the Judicial Department intends to rely on this bill to allow the use of DOC facilities as county courtrooms or state courtrooms, that intent should be clearly stated to you on the record so that the entire legislature and the public have sufficient notice of this intent and may fully and fairly debate these issues. As stated in ORS 1.040, courts must be public. As an example of what that means, the U.S. Supreme Court has stated, quote, traditionally, state capitol grounds are open to the public. Jails built for security purposes are not, end quote.
Yes,
Jane? Yep. I'm almost done, but go ahead.
Well, it looks like you've got several pages more here to go, and I think your point is well taken, and I wondered if we could have Mr. Ickes come up and maybe ask him about what the intent is in regard to this, and maybe we can kind of cut to the chase here and see if there's amendments that are necessary or what the intent actually is.
If you, with your permission, Chair, the amendment that I've offered is on the final page of my testimony, which is at page 6 in bold. And if the Department of Corrections or the Judicial Department is willing to state on the record that they're not intending to hold any more jury trials inside the prisons, that's fine, but I still would urge you to amend and add this language so in case they change their mind after this session or new people come in, that this protects your legislative intent on this bill. Again, this bill is extremely open-ended and vague. And as far as the stated purpose for it, you know, I think that it's a fine stated purpose, and I don't have any argument against that. However, I do know that the courts have proffered a basis for holding jury trials inside prisons is saving money. And I think the risk posed to the public is not worth the money saved. I don't think we have any workers' comp for jurors. I don't think the state offers any liability. In fact, it explicitly exempts people who are visiting a prison facility from liability, from tort liability coverage. And I just would like you to consider this issue and decide how you feel about it as legislature. because the executive branch and the judicial branch of governments are acting and holding jury trials inside prisons without any express authority from you. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions before we bring Mr. Ickes back up? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ickes, can you shed some light on this for us?
Chairman Knope, members of the committee, I cannot speak to that issue. I do not understand its exact relationship to this bill. It is not the intent of this bill to expand the use of correctional facilities as courtrooms, but to use the authority that would be granted to provide us with the authority to contract for services with local communities where the cost benefit of doing so is clear. She raises a related but separate issue around the use of correctional facilities, and from a legal perspective, I can't speak to what she's where she is going with her concerns. But it is not the interest of this particular bill to expand the use of correctional facilities as courtrooms.
Thank you. Representative Leonard.
But Section 2, subsection 2, does say a contract or agreement. And then two, under subsection one of this section, may authorize the use of department facilities. And then goes on, would you have an objection to the amendment on page six of Ms. Jade's testimony to clear up any misunderstanding that may arise?
My concern is, Chairman Knope, Representative Leonard, my concern is that if I were, I do not understand that particular issue well enough to respond to it at this time. It would seem to me that since correctional facilities have been used as courtrooms, that to agree to that would negate our ability to continue to use a present practice that's in place. And I'm not in a position really at this point to comment on that. I could get back to you if you'd like me to.
I would. I don't know how the rest of the feels. I would like
I think that would certainly be helpful for as a clarifying issue.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Ickes while he's up again? Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ickes, is were you aware of this practice at the other institution before today?
Chairman Knope, Representative Nelson, yes, I am.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
And had you had previous cause to be concerned about the safety of the people, the public, that would be coming to that facility for a public case, a court trial?
Chairman Knope, Representative Nelson, no, I do not have reason for concern.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Mr. Ickes, are you aware if there was additional security provisioning made to protect the public at this court trial? At the prison?
Representative Knope, Chair Knope, Representative Nelson, I am aware that Superintendent Lampert, I think, took all reasonable steps that he could take in making sure that that particular court experience was consistent with law and a safe place for people to be.
Thank you. Representative. Hold on. Representative Merkley, did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'll just ask you to include this in the information you bring back to us, but my question for you to take and consider is whether there have been previous concerns expressed about the trials in prison not being available to the public and whether that really fulfills the spirit of the provisions for public trials.
Representative Leonard, do you have a question?
Representative Zahner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have one question, possibly for Rose. You mentioned you got a couple lawsuits going. When will those be resolved, and how does that affect this that we're trying to do?
While she's coming up, too, I'd also like to note that the rest of her testimony is going to be in this written document.
Okay.
limit myself to answering that question. Thank you, Chair. As far as the state criminal appeals, I have filed my appellate brief, and I think the state is due in the end of March. The federal civil rights case is stayed pending the Court of Appeals ruling on the criminal case. I can't give you any more information beyond that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Ickes while we have him up here? Thank you. And heading down the witness list, Russ Spencer, Oregon Sheriff's Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Russ Spencer for the Sheriff's. Well, it's always a pleasure to go later on in the witness list. Well, I will start off by just reiterating a couple of things that previous witnesses had attested to. The intent of this bill is to allow local county correctional facilities to contract with the state for two things basically, talking health care and medical services, treatment services, and we're talking about tactical assistance. On the health care end of things, the point I think has been pretty clearly made. It's also in the letter you have from Sheriff Trumbo. What we're looking at is an attempt to control costs and to provide a maximum benefit to the taxpayers and still provide the highest quality care that we can to the prisoners that are in our custody, an obligation that we have. It makes sense to us, given the purchasing power that the Department of Corrections has, to take advantage of those kinds of economies of scale that they can avail themselves of. On the tactical end of things, what we're talking about are things like cell extractions. In the Umatilla County Jail, we cannot afford to keep a fully trained and fully operational cell extraction team. But a cell extraction operation is a mixture of both art and science. It's not something that you don't just go in there and haul the guy out of there. It can be a very, very tricky, dangerous, volatile situation. And the Department of Corrections has a highly trained, professional, and capable team that we would like to be able to avail ourselves of. They are 5 minutes away from the Umatilla County Jail. So it's an opportunity for a timely and professional response that serves the public safety. In the event that we were to have some sort of large-scale disturbance, like a riot or some part of or a hostage situation, something like that, again, DOC has people who are trained to work in confined spaces with the types of persons that we are dealing with here and provide invaluable assistance to us in that regard. It's a two-way street. If there was a major incident at at EOCI or Two Rivers, most certainly sheriff's deputies would be responding to assist in any way that was requested from the director or the superintendent. So that's what we're looking for there. As to the issue of holding judicial proceedings in state correctional institutions, I got to admit, it's a new one to me. The question that I would ask, the first question I would ask, is why was the trial being held in the penitentiary, in the maximum security facility that they have? There must be a reason. Judges do not routinely think it's a neat thing to take a field trip and enter into a high security environment, so they must have felt that there was some sort of a security reason for doing this. I assume. I don't know that. I'm not familiar with this particular case. I've looked at the amendment language that Ms. Jade is proposing, and again, not being an attorney and not being fully conversant with all of the statutes that this may affect, I'm a little concerned to start with in that we currently operate video arraignment procedures in a number of our county jails, which both enhances the safety to the public and is an efficiency to the county sheriff's office and the judicial department. They're effective, they're safe, they work. I would not be eager to proceed with anything that may potentially endanger that. I will tell you that if there's some conspiracy out there to use this bill as a method to start holding regular trials in state prison facilities, nobody briefed me in on the conspiracy. So that is not what we're talking about. What we are looking for here, as I said, are the health care and economic benefits and the tactical assistance, and that's it. If I'm capable of answering any questions that you may have, I'll sure give it my best shot.
Mr. Spencer, I understand that it's likely not the Department of Corrections' intent to turn this into a courtroom issue, and is there any way that you see, besides the language that we've been given by Ms. Jade, to tighten this up to, so this particular measure, if we pass it, couldn't be used as an excuse to open it up further?
Mr. Chairman, I suspect possibly, and again, something you would want to run by real live attorneys and not me, but on line 9 in section 2, you have provided local governments under this section may include but need not be limited to. If you took out need not be limited to, I'm not sure what potential other assistance we might be giving up there, but certainly we could come back and revisit it if we find that we've somehow precluded ourselves from some other reasonable assistance that they could offer. In that case, then we would be talking about health care services, treatment services, and tactical assistance. I think that would foreclose the issue of judicial proceedings, but again.
So a further definition of the services that might be offered or entered into in these agreements seems reasonable.
I think you could certainly do that, or as I said, just take out the words, but need not be limited to. I think when I first read that, to be honest with you, I think that was just sort of a fail-safe type of thing in there. I felt like what we were asking for was sufficiently addressed by the health care, treatment, and tactical assistance language. So I would be comfortable with taking that language out. I don't know if that resolves Ms. Jade's concerns or if it gets to the issue that she's raised or not. I would defer to the attorneys to interpret that.
Questions for Mr. Spencer? Representative Nelson?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Spencer, I mean, having a trial is not the only thing. You know, when you're going into Section 2.2, isn't the issue the use of these facilities for any event for which the public could attend? I mean, you could have the county commissioners meeting there if you wanted to. I felt that the question was that this is not the appropriate place to have public meetings and or trials, anything to which, by law, we're required to invite the public to. So could we limit it in the way of, that focus?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I think perhaps you could. I see your point, and I think I agree with you. If you were to put in some language, I believe the intent of that section is to allow us to take our prisoners to a state prison medical facility so that they can receive treatment there. So if you were to put perhaps some language in the use of department facilities, personnel, equipment, or material in providing, and then go back up to that other language again, wherever it was, health care.
Line 10.
Line 10, correct. Health care services, treatment services, and tactical assistance.
And follow up, please. And perhaps including the word limiting. Using the facilities, personnel, equipment, or material. Limiting the use of those to health care services, treatment services, technical assistance for the benefit of the sheriff's department.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, off the top of my head, I think that would be fine. I would want to, run it by our people just to make sure that we're not inadvertently leaving out some area of assistance that was contemplated when we originally brought this forward. But I have no objection to that. In concept, like I said, it's not our intent to try to expand judicial proceedings and correctional facilities. As a general rule, I don't think that anybody that doesn't have to be in a correctional facility ought to be in a correctional facility. They're not fun places.
Any other questions for Mr. Spencer? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mary Botkin, next on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. And I actually have an idea. I'm just working on it here.
Take your time.
trying to help the committee come up with words, I have to say that
legal counsel being pressed for all kinds of time, appreciate your help.
The witness from Lincoln County certainly brought up an interesting issue that none of us had looked at. Our organization actually has no, quote, official position on this bill. We certainly have no problem philosophically sharing the expertise and the staff, the staffing abilities that we have to assist other law enforcement agencies in a crisis situation, or as staffing permits with health care treatment for local county, local jails and county facilities. I would be remiss if I did not say that at a time when we're kind of cutting the budget, we have some concern about our capacity ability and how much we have the ability to respond to our own problems, much less somebody else's. And make no mistake, that has nothing to do with the commitment on the part of the officers. It's just a matter of having enough people inside the institution to keep each other safe, much less help out other folks in the community. But I think that in talking with Mr. Spencer, I think that actually it might, if utilized properly, might actually put us in a position of possibly being able to maintain some funding that we don't currently have to keep security staff that we would otherwise not be able to keep. And as long as the counties understand that they've got to pay for what they get, then I think that's okay. I can see where our prisons offer a great resource, especially in rural Oregon, for local law enforcement officials, and I agree that our folks are very well trained in very specific areas that most local folks do not get trained in. So, having said that, Kathy from Juvenile Rights Project actually helped with this, and what she suggested we do with this language was to just simply say under this section that it would be limited to health care services, treatment services, and tactical assistance. And I think Mr. Spencer's right. I think those are the three key areas. And if in the next 2 years we figure out there was something that we could provide that they are not able to take advantage of, you certainly can come back and request some expansion. And it also gives us somewhat limited ability to see if it works, both from our perspective as well as from theirs. And again, the only concern we have is a budget concern. It's not a commitment concern. So it's just, do we have enough bodies to go around if there's a problem? So anyway, that's our suggestion, and those are our concerns. And I thank the committee, and I don't have anything more to offer.
Thank you. Mr. Ickes has maybe some new language. Couple attorneys in the back of the room, maybe. Come to
Chairman Knoop. I don't have a solution. I really would like to have an opportunity to talk to our council about the language. Let me just say that I didn't get a chance in the earlier part to say that this is a pilot project by the Supreme Court. And I don't know if this is clear, but the only people that are in this court are people who are in our care. This is not people from the public coming into prison to have a trial. These are people who are already in our care. But there may be services that we would be asked to offer that might not be in one of those three. And so if we could put to rest the concerns of it being construed too broadly, which is not our intention, we would probably be able to bring back very quickly to your office or wherever you would like language that I think addresses the clear intent of this particular bill.
Mr. Chair, I think that'd be wise. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just struck by your comment that the only people in this court are the people in your care. Well, of course the prisoners are, sir. But you're bringing in jurors. You're bringing in people from the outside. And obviously, you're not bringing in court reporters, because at this moment, I'm going to take a moment to tell you what I think of this transcript. It's an abomination to to read a transcript that has several inaudibles on every page created by an electronic court reporter. So this is my moment to tell you that if the state thinks they're saving money on this kind of crap, they're not, because this is an inadequate record. So that aside, I disagree with you that only the people that are in that court are in your facility. And I think the witness has raised some very serious questions that need to be addressed.
Thank you, Representative Winter.
What was I going to say? Oh, I know what I was going to say. I should have asked you this earlier, but isn't it possible under current law to enter into intergovernmental agreements from a department agency to another branch of government?
Chairman Knope, Representative Leonard, the answer is yes. In this particular case, however, we have a Court of Appeals decision about ORS 19110, and on the advice of our counsel, they said very clearly that we needed this language.
And that might have been helpful to hear that in your testimony earlier. I mean, what is a Court of Appeals decision relative to ORS 19110?
The message was that we needed to come to your, to the legislature and ask for this authority.
Mr. Rickies, I'm asking you what was the issue that gave rise to the Court of Appeals saying that you needed some authorization to enter into an intergovernmental agreement?
I can get the name of that the case if you'd like me to, but I do not know the details of the case.
What? Mr. Chair, it's rather profound that there's some case outstanding that will limit the ability of government to enter intergovernmental agreements. I know in the city of Portland we do that all the time. The state does it with other states in terms of State Compensation Act, and I know police agencies do it between states, so I guess I'm hard-pressed to understand why within the borders of Oregon a state agency can enter into an intergovernmental agreement with a county agency.
Office of Children and Families versus the Klamath Tribe was the Court of Appeals decision that our lawyers told us governed this particular area.
I think we need to hear what that is.
Yeah, if we could get some more information on that and possibly some language to tighten us up a little bit, I think it would be real helpful for the committee. Any other questions for Mr. Rickies while he's up here again? If not, thank you, sir. And we will call Paul Snyder from the Association of Oregon Counties, it looks like.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm appearing in support of House Bill 2094. And I'm going to just forget all the things that I was going to say because the hearing has taken a different twist. I was a little bit concerned. As a matter of fact, I was feeling the same concern that Representative Leonard just expressed. Why do we need this bill? And also concerned that if we do need this bill for this particular circumstance, what other circumstances are we going to need bills for in order for state agencies to do intergovernmental agreements? I haven't read the case, but I have discussed just a little while ago the circumstances, that the case exists with the Assistant Attorney General who was given the advice of the Department of Corrections about this. And from that conversation, I became satisfied that it sounds like it's a narrow issue. My understanding of ORS Chapter 190 is to, in fact, it says so in there, it shall be construed broadly to encourage intergovernmental cooperation so that state agencies and local governments and the federal government can do things efficiently. And I can cite a number of cases where it would be just downright ridiculous not to have this kind of intergovernmental cooperation because it would cost the taxpayers a bundle and they become irate thinking about state parks, people going out to mow the lawn on a state park that's right next door to a county park, and the county people going out to mow the lawn in the county park. Why would we do that? It doesn't make any sense. So in I'll take a look at this case, but I've, from my conversations with the Assistant Attorney General on this, it sounds somewhat narrow. They said basically, as I understand it, that the State Department of Corrections does not have authority currently to deal with county jail inmates. It's not in their delegated authority. If that's the case, then maybe it is a narrow issue that we can address with this bill. But I would echo the concerns that Mr. Spencer has raised in response to the concerns from Ms. Jade. I'd be narrow in terms of any amendment that the committee would adopt in response to those concerns, that so that they don't create circumstances that nobody intended to create.
And I think that would be certainly my intent, would be to, you know, to allow what's going on currently to continue as it relates to, you know, your video conferencing and all those issues that obviously are saving the state a lot of money. However, I don't think it's the intent of the committee, and apparently not of the bill drafters, to expand it beyond what it already is. So if we can come up with some language that people can agree that will accomplish those issues, I think we've got a bill that can see the floor in the near future. Otherwise, I think we're going to be stuck here.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would just point out that I agree with what Mr. Snyder said. If we need a bill to accomplish this kind of an intergovernmental agreement, you could actually be passing legislation that inhibits future intergovernmental agreements, this being the precedent.
Potential
precedent. If you pass legislation because you think you need statutory authority to enter an intergovernmental agreement on these issues, and somebody might raise that issue on other issues as well. So I would caution that we might, if at all possible, not need a bill at all for them to accomplish Umatilla County what they want to accomplish, because you might, in the long run, be doing more harm by passing a law allowing that than encouraging the department to do it based on the current statute.
And I think the sage advice of the good representative is in order. Mr. Snyder?
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think it'd be worthwhile to take a look at this case and to see what kind of language is necessary to fashion for it. And then I think a lot of the problem can be addressed by creating a record and legislative intent along the lines of, you know, nothing in this bill is intended to diminish the capacity of this agency or any other agency to enter into intergovernmental agreements on things for which it's already authorized to do so, or something along those lines, to address Representative Leonard's concerns and still get the purpose.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who needs to testify on this bill, which is not moving today? That was kind of a hint in the chair. If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2094 and look for further contact from the parties outside of the hearing room, and hopefully we'll be able to come up with some clarity. I believe we have a hearing in recess, don't we?
We do. We started on House Bill 2588, which is the last item on your agenda. The only other bill that you have not heard is House Bill 2102, which is second on your agenda.
Seeing as I believe we do have some private citizens here, or at least one maybe, to testify on House Bill 2588, let's reopen that public hearing and call Lou Ann Meyer, who's been waiting so patiently for a bill that we thought would be fairly simple, which turned into not be so simple.
Oh, no.
Good afternoon. My name is Lou Ann Meyer. I'm a certified public accountant with a tax practice in Dallas, Oregon, and I thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. House Bill 2588 is a request asking that the Oregon Department Employment Division's payroll filing requirements conform to the federal filing requirements. I believe the best way to illustrate this is just in the form of an example. What is being passed out to you at this moment is just a short one-page example, and I just ask that each of you identify yourself either with Tom, John, or Mary. Suppose we have a corporation, we will call it Smith and Smith, Inc., and there are, it's a small corporation, three shareholders, Tom, John, and Mary. And each of them earn $150,000 a year. When filing payroll reports in regards to the employer's taxes, each shareholder, the employer is only going to match Social Security taxes for the year 2000 on $76,200. That's at a rate of 6.2% last year. For state unemployment tax, as soon as that shareholder has earned $23,000, the employer does not have to pay any more state employment tax on that individual. And for federal unemployment taxes, as soon as they have earned $7,000, there are no more payroll taxes to be paid. The company itself will file a form called a Form 941 in which they report the total wages every shareholder has earned, and they report the Social Security tax that they have to pay on that shareholder. They file a Form OQ that goes to the Employment Division in which they're going to pay the taxes on the maximum of the $23,000, and they'll file for the year a Form 940 for federal unemployment taxes up to a maximum of $7,000. Now, I know this isn't exciting, but the bottom line here is going to be an illustration to show you that these shareholders will be subject twice on their wages with the Employment Division, and they are not subject twice with the IRS. So the second part of this example is to bring up a limited liability company, a single member limited liability company. That means there's only one person that essentially owns the company. The IRS presently says if an LLC is a single member, you are to essentially disregard it as an entity for certain filing requirements. It doesn't file a tax return, it doesn't have payroll reports to file, it doesn't even apply for a federal ID number. But it is a separate entity for liability protection reasons. All right, with this illustration, what I'm saying is, suppose we create an LLC that's called Pine Tree, and the only member is Smith & Smith, Inc. In other words, that other corporation is its member. What it means is all the activity of Pine Tree LLC is going to be reported on the tax return of Smith & Smith, Inc. And likewise, all the employees of Pine Tree LLC for federal report purposes will be reported on the 941 of Smith & Smith, Inc. The bottom line being is presently the Employment Division, the state of Oregon, is requiring these single-member LLCs to get an ID number, and the LLC will file its OQ report, and it will pay on... And in the illustration says, suppose that you're devoting half your time to Smith & Smith, Inc. and half your time to Pine Tree, and you earn $75,000 over here and $75,000 over here. You're still earning your $150,000. What will happen is Pine Tree has to file an OQ report and will pay taxes on your $23,000 here, and it's going to pay taxes on your $23,000 earned over here by Smith & Smith, Inc. Not a huge savings in taxes, obviously, because your employment tax rate can vary anywhere from 1%, 3%, 4%, 5%. The huge issue here is this is very, very confusing for people trying to file payroll reports within companies, not understanding why do I only file an OQ report for this entity. I'm confused trying to keep the wages separate and straight. When IRS says they find it all over here in issue 1, W-2, et cetera. End of case. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Meyer? Representative Nelson.
Okay, this is so simple. Lou-Ann?
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Lou-Ann, why is this taking so long for us to get to this? I mean, have we just been living with this all our lives?
LLCs are relatively new.
Oh, is that it?
Yes, yes.
And how new is, excuse me, follow-up, please, Mr. Chair, how new is
years,
new?
3-4 years. And I would say single-member LLCs are not real common, but it's becoming more and more common. Now, oftentimes you'll see a sole proprietor that's a single-member LLC, and this doesn't impact it. It impacts it when a corporation decides to be the member of an LLC.
And that is new.
I would say relatively new.
Thank you. Is it Jane Martin from the Employment Department? / Marion? What does that mean? Does that mean you're...
County.
Ah, there you go. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jane Martin, and I'm a manager in the tax section of the Employment Department. And Mrs. Myers, I think, went over and described exactly what happens with the current situation. There is no provision in Oregon Employment Department law that provides for a disregarded entity. And House Bill 2588 would allow us to do that. And the impact only happens when a disregarded entity has a shared employer, the same employee that the parent company has, and that individual is paid more than the taxable wage base. So that may be one of the reasons why it hasn't popped up before this. Mm-hmm. And the disregarded entity, our recollection is that it was in 1996 in the IRS law. So I think that's why we're getting to this issue as an issue in our employment department law. This change, we do not believe, would make a big impact on the trust fund because it would be that rare situation. It would have minimal changes to our procedures and our processes, and it would have no impact on the claimants. Their total payroll would be reported, and so there would be no impact on their claims. So very minimal impact, very narrow, as Representative Shatterly explained earlier. Any questions?
Thank you. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Ms. Martin, is there any scenario where the employee would be separated from one half of the shared entity and not the other? And I see your testimony that it would have no impact on the wage credits. I'm just trying to figure out, would their eligibility, if they separated from
Representative
one and not the other, be affected?
If I understand the question, if an individual is separated from one place of employment that's working for another, then my understanding is they wouldn't be eligible for unemployment. Now, if they are only working part-time, I'm not an expert on unemployment insurance claims, but I believe there might be some ability there for a part-time claim. I'm not positive on that. But if they're working full-time, then they're not eligible mm-hmm. for unemployment. But so it pretty much would not impact
them. But follow-up, this bill would not affect that scenario.
It doesn't change their eligibility at all. It just changes basically the taxation for the employers and gives them a benefit.
Any other questions?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson, you can't just smile at me.
No, I know. I can decide.
Got a signal here.
That's right.
You're always smiling at me.
Well, something, I don't know, I was born with it or can't get rid of it or something, or the dentist did something good for me one time or something. Oh, good. Thank you. Luann, Mr. Chair, Luann, do you have any idea what the impact is, the bottom line of this, or maybe our great administrator already found this out and I didn't find it?
Actually, this is, yeah.
We're losing money anywhere?
No, I don't.
At all, whatsoever?
I don't think we are, but this is Jane Martin, and she...
Oh, I mean Jane. Sorry.
Mr.
Jane.
Chair, Representative Nelson, good question. We're not positive how much we would be losing to the trust fund, but we believe it would be minimal because it's only when the disregarded entity has the same employee as the parent company or the owner and that individual earns over the taxable wage base. An example that we had created, I believe it's in the testimony, is if an individual had received $40,000 payroll, $20,000 from both companies, they would be taxed in the year 2001. It's up to $25,000. So the savings for that company would be $300. We had not heard of this situation mm-hmm. before, so if Ms. Myers, I'm not sure how many accounts she knows of this, but $300 per employee in that example. So it's minimal, we think, the impact of the trust fund. But there we do believe there would be some minimal.
Any other questions? Yes?
No.
No signal there? Well, I'm just seeing signals all over the place. There aren't signals at all. Representative Merkley's scratching his ear, and I think it's sold the Representative Merkley.
Mr. Chair, I believe it's because we have juggled so many hearings today and up and down. It's kind of a jigsaw puzzle today.
I guess so. Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2588? Don't see anybody that wants to testify, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2588. And I am going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2102, since we have it's like a couple of witnesses in the room on this particular bill. And Colonel Caldwell is not here to provide security for the second hearing in a row. So we thought maybe we ought to give him a chance to speak this time. And then maybe we could head back to that other bill, or we'll schedule it for a session on a later date if we don't have time. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2102.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for affording us the opportunity to bring this proposal before you. Hopefully it'll be less strained than perhaps some of your other hearings today. We asked our Commander-in-Chief, Governor Kitzhaber, to introduce this bill for us, House Bill 2102, to grant the Oregon Military Department authority to obtain nationwide criminal offender information from the Department of State Police on subject individuals when the information is required as a job qualifier. In October of 1998, the governor signed Executive Order 9819, which granted us the access to the Oregon State Police criminal offender information system for enforcement of the 10th U.S. Code, Section 504, National Gun Control Act, and for conducting background checks on prospective employees of the National Guard Youth Challenge Program. Soon after this order was published, we learned that the criminal background information did not include FBI criminal history information, and that's pursuant to Public Law 92-544. The agency must have statutory authority to obtain the national criminal history records from the FBI. We use this information for employment purposes. The primary reason, if you look at the job qualifications that we're looking at in our job categories, are individuals who are hired at our Youth Challenge Program in Central Oregon. These are at-risk youth alternative education program. And we also use it for personnel hired at our Air National Guard air bases. And these folks protect essential mission operational resources, state and federal property, primarily federal. And these people are subject to the Lautenberg Amendments to the Gun Control Act of 1968, also known as the Brady Bill. And we also want to use it for applicants hired for jobs where fiscal and purchasing responsibility are primary duties. And we have found in the past where we don't have this information that we unfortunately end up, unbeknownst to hiring folks who have had difficulties, and that causes us great anguish in trying to situate them in places after they've completed their minimum time in places where their past won't affect them. And we just don't think it's a good hiring practice to begin with. The people who would be subject to this are the folks that we're hiring, and these are folks, again, who are working in restricted areas and military installations and flight lines, aircraft hangars, areas where you have to have secret clearances, et cetera. So that's pretty much what this bill does. It's pretty straightforward. Not designed to go on any witch hunts. It's just in order to help us clear up our hiring practices so we can get the appropriate people doing the appropriate job without later finding out we haven't done so. And that concludes my testimony. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Colonel Caldwell? Representative Nelson?
Chairman Knopf, I want to take advantage of this opportunity to ask Colonel Caldwell something. Not directly on the subject. Just wondering if can my public schools contract with the National Guard to run our dropout program for our high schools?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, as you were learning earlier, we have the ability under Chapter 190 to do contracting with other agencies. However, I would say that and that we run this federally supported program currently, and our facilities and federal funding limit us to a certain number of students a year, which is a total of 300, I don't think we would be your best alternative for that regard, simply because we don't have the trained staff. What we have now is a very good program over in Central Oregon that has produced marvelous results with the students that we bring in. I'm very proud of that results, and I think we're probably at capacity with respect to what we're able to do right now. I don't say we can't, I'm just not sure we would.
Thank you. Any other questions for Colonel Caldwell?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenberg.
Thank you. Colonel Caldwell, what typically is the educational and professional background of the faculty that you use in the program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, it depends on the job that they're doing. Right now we use a state classification system that is identical or almost identical to Oregon Youth Authority. So what we're looking at is we're looking at different capacities. For education purposes, we contract for the school itself, the educational part of it, the classroom. We have a contract with the Ben Lapine School District. We are a satellite school of Ben Lapine. We're not a standalone school district. We're not a standalone school. We're an alternative school officially under Ben Lapine. And so therefore we have to meet the same requirements that Ben Lapine does. So in essence they hire the instructors and we augment them with other staff who do other functions, GLC is a group life coordinator, right? So we have group life coordinators, we have different levels of group life coordinators. And that's pretty much how we modeled the program, so we could fit inside the classification system offered by the state of Oregon without creating a whole new entity for 48 employees. Does that answer your question?
Well, not actually. I was asking really what training, I mean, are there people in so many different classifications that you can't really answer what their training or...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, we have numerous classifications. We have counselors, which are required to fit the state's job classification requirements. We have group life coordinators that have to fit the same requirements as the OIA folks do to work with the kids. We have leadership people who fit the same requirements that we would with any department. And, of course, we have instructional staff, which, again, is contracted and meet those educational requirements. We also have... not a physician, but a physician's assistant. And again, they got to meet the state requirements. So we didn't go out and create something. We didn't reinvent the wheel. We took what was on the table and we basically put it, employed it in every aspect of our operation. Now, the educational requirements, typically you have to have a high school diploma, a high school certificate to be employed with the state. There are certain jobs that require two years of education, four-year degrees. Just depends on what capacity they're working in. Does that help?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Any other questions for Colonel Caldwell? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it. Don't need any amendments to this?
Mr. Chairman, no amendments have been proposed by anyone for this bill. The fiscal impact is minimal. We have a statement that says there will be no statement, and we have a little piece of paper that says no revenue impact on this bill.
Okay. Well,
all right.
In that case, anyone else wishing to testify before I close public hearing on 2102? If not, I will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2102.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zahner.
I'd like to make a motion that we move 2102 to the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Zahner has moved House Bill 2102 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any questions or discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Excuse
me.
Aye.
Jackson?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Markley?
Aye.
Nelson?
Aye.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Walker?
Aye.
Snow?
Aye.
Is that it? Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2102 is declared passed, and we need a carrier.
On the consent calendar?
Most committees make the person who made the motion carry the bill.
Well, I put on the consent.
Yes, right.
No, it should be.
Doesn't this meet the category for consent calendar?
No,
I'm so moved.
Representative Leonard objects. Honors the carrier.
There we go.
Work session closed.
What I'm talking about.
How about that?
Thanks, Donna.
On the radio.
Awesome to be in action.
On the radio.
We want to hear a lot from Representative Honor this session. That golden voice he's got.
That's the microphone.
Yeah, big mouth.
Do you guys have any concerns about 25-88?
No.
Ready to go to work session with that?
We're going to move on to, I think, the last agenda item, and that would be to go to work session, House Bill 2588, which we heard earlier. And even though the Leonard Rule will not apply on every bill, so don't be afraid to make a motion, and we'll be here indefinitely.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Nelson.
On behalf of... this committee, I move that we move House Bill 2588 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation and place it on the consent calendar.
Well, we've got to do two separate motions.
Before.
We'll take the first motion. Is this
something? Mr. Chairman, this one does have a subsequent referral from the Speaker to the Committee on Revenue. We have a statement that says no revenue impact, and I don't think the Revenue Committee has any jurisdiction over the unemployment tax, which is what the tax is that this relates to.
So we could rescind that request, and I could go to which side? Is that the...
You could talk to the Speaker.
You would be requesting. In all cases, the Speaker makes the subsequent referrals and rescinds and adds, so you'd be requesting.
Request. Mm-hmm. And do we need to do that in the form of a motion, or do I just do that?
You would need to do that in the form of a motion, Mr. Chair.
Uh-huh. So could we add that, have Representative Nelson add that to her motion?
There are many ways of doing it.
Mr. Chair, I so move.
Well, Representative Nelson has moved House Bill 2588 to the floor with a due pass recommendation requesting that we rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So we
revenue.
I'm sorry, to revenue. And we will make that request. Any discussion or questions? Dr. Clerk will call the roll.
Sonner.
Aye.
Jackson.
Aye.
Leonard.
No.
Merkley.
Aye.
Nelson.
Aye.
Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Walker.
Aye.
Wilson.
Wilson's excused.
No.
Aye. I mean, received a required number of votes, a constitutional majority, as it were. Representative Merkley, are you...
No.
Still the maker of the motion,
no,
Mr. Chair.
Are we still...
That's a long standing tradition. Sure. The Oregon legislature, the maker of the motion, carries the bill.
Well, I believe it's on the consent calendar.
I need to refer you to your rules.
It cannot go to the consent calendar because Representative Leonard voted no, and Representative Nelson is the carrier. Work session closed. House 2588.
I think I've just learned legislature 101. Oh my goodness!
Yeah, wait till you explain that bill.
Goodness.
I'm going to sell tickets.
Let the record. Let the record note that Kumbaya is over. Representative Leonard has voted no in committee.
So much for that's what it was.
Mr. Shepherd, is there anything else on the agenda that this committee needs to take care of?
Now we're going to carry the two bills over, and we'll talk about
this
the
is gonna
date you want to schedule those
posters.
For. You've reported two bills out, so that
ends you to come out and play, Tom.
Is there anything else for the good of the committee? If not, the committee is adjourned 13
okay.
and a half minutes early.
Started 13.
I want to just get back to that.